This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the role volunteers play in maintaining and showcasing Wisconsin's state parks, forests, and trails. Now, it's the second week of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and unarmed civilians are being killed by attacks from Russia. Russia is also taking control of two of Ukraine's four nuclear energy facilities, raising concerns from international observers. We're talking about the latest developments in Russia's war against Ukraine, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been following the news about what's happening there, what are your thoughts, your questions, your reactions? How do you think the U.S. should respond, if at all? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. He's an expert on armed conflict, foreign policy, and nuclear weapons. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back on the show.
Before we get into some specific issues, Andrew, what are your thoughts at this stage now over a week into this invasion?
Two big things. One, it's gone much worse for Russia than they anticipated. They thought that, well before now, actually, that they would have had time to secure control of the capital, Kyiv, replace the previous government, the existing current government, with some government to their liking, presumably, and probably capture the other big city in the north, Kharkiv, and basically have secured control of the country. And it's just very far from that happening at this point. Their troops have bogged down. The Ukrainian army has put up a lot of resistance that they didn't anticipate, and the Ukrainian government has shown itself to be incredibly resilient and good at mobilizing not just within Ukraine but international opposition to the Russian invasion. So very much not what they were hoping for.
You'd said two main things. That one was unexpected resistance, Russia moving slower than expected.
Definitely moving slower than expected. I mean, they thought they initially invaded with fairly light forces, hoping that they would, I guess, just quickly go in without any big opposition and seize the major objectives, mostly Kyiv, the capital in the north. But they met stiff resistance, and then they had to send in the rest of their forces. They've committed now, it's estimated, 95 to 100% of the forces that they had gathered around Ukraine prior to the invasion. But they are still not making progress. They're still very much bogged down.
One of the main concerns now, since the beginning, actually, has been the threat to the civilian population in Ukraine. Well over a million people have fled the country already just days into this, and concerns about Russian troops either targeting civilians or indiscriminately firing and endangering civilians. What are you watching for as we see those reports?
Two things. One is that you're seeing, and the major one is going to be shelling of large population areas. Again, the capital of Kyiv and Kharkiv in the north are the main battle sites, but also Mariupol in the south, and potentially eventually Odessa could come under attack. So the Russian, once the blitzkrieg, you know, quick victory hopes have faded, the Russians are probably going to resort to the way they fought in Chechnya and the way they fought in Syria more recently, which is to simply use artillery to pound residential areas that are being held by the opposition, regardless of the fact that there are civilians in those areas as well, which will lead to large numbers of civilian casualties and the destruction of those residential areas and buildings. There's also documented episodes of firing upon civilians in more direct ways, people who are fleeing or people who are, you know, identifiable as civilians in the street. And I think that will happen probably less than, but I think in terms of casualties, the main numbers are going to be as a result of this sort of indiscriminate shelling of residential areas.
Talking to Andrew Kidd from UW-Madison, political science professor there, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Delavan. Chris, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just have a question about the sanctions. That's largely like the entire Western response to the situation of just imposing sanctions on Russia. And from, you know, my perspective, which is not an expert perspective, it just seems like Russia and China are kind of like buddying up with each other. And I'm kind of worried that, you know, China's just going to sit back and kind of watch what happens, and it might encourage them to kind of carry out the same, you know, attack on Taiwan and in the future. And what I would be curious about that is, it is, would China be as affected by sanctions in that situation? And would that have this, would that just have the same effect as the sanctions are having on Russia right now?
Chris, thanks for the call. A lot there, Andrew. Let's start with Russia and China, their relationship here, how China has reacted to this invasion.
Sure. So Russia and China were relatively close prior to the invasion, both shared a antagonism towards the United States and what they perceived as American domination of the world or hegemony, both pushing back on that, Russia in their vicinity, especially in Ukraine and Eastern Europe, and China in their vicinity, especially Taiwan and the South China Seas. So they shared interests in that regard. So that has been true. However, China has not been exactly vocal in its defense of Russia in this episode. It's not clear that Putin cleared this with China or even let them know significantly beforehand. So the Chinese have not been enthusiastic about it for a whole variety of reasons. And an interesting aspect, I think you've touched upon one aspect, which is the sanctions, right? The Western response to this invasion has been much, much more unified than anyone anticipated it would be, and much stronger, and has imposed much greater costs on Russia. We're now even talking about an oil embargo, like not purchasing Russian energy exports. And basically, when you've got oil and agricultural exports like wheat, that's about it in terms of Russian exports. So those are going to be very severe sanctions. Now, when it comes to China, China is a much, much bigger economy. The Chinese economy is almost as large as the United States economy. And so in some senses, it seems less vulnerable to external pressure. However, it also is heavily integrated with the rest of the world in terms of export markets. They export all kinds of things to the United States and to Western Europe. And if those markets were just shut off over some behavior like invading Taiwan, that could be very catastrophic for the Chinese economy. And I think it sort of sends a message to China that you know, it's not necessarily smart to underestimate the response of Western countries to blatant acts of territorial aggression like this. The Chinese might have thought that they could get away with invading Taiwan. They may still think that. But this episode, I would say, has given them a bit of food for thought there, because the West has been much more vigorous in its response than people anticipated.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jim joins us now in Hartford. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the United States is being very short-sighted. These sanctions really are not working so far. I think China and Russia are playing a long game. And you got to know that they both have discussed this before they made their moves. It's just a big chess game, and I think it's a longer game than we're anticipating. And I just think it's just a human tragedy that we're just sitting by watching all these people get killed on the nightly news, families uprooted and killed and slaughtered. I mean, and it's going to continue. And our response is basically like a cancel culture sort of. And these sanctions, I got to think that they've calculated all of this. They've thought of the worst case scenario. And even though Putin is facing, and I'm glad to see it, I'm glad he's kind of getting his butt kicked. But I think they calculated this. I think they could survive a longer period if they're in for the long run.
Jim, I gotcha. Andrew, sounds like Jim wants more than sanctions. There is lethal military aid now, U.S. and Western countries, all the way over to Poland, sending some lethal aid. The next escalation people have talked about is some kind of no-fly zone preventing Russian aircraft from operating over Ukraine. What do you think of that as an option?
I think that would be a big mistake. So I think it's important to point out that the military aid to Ukraine has been prompt and effective as far as we can tell. not just the United States, but many NATO countries and even non-NATO countries like Sweden and Finland have sent the Ukrainians exactly what they need, which is portable, easily carried anti-tank weapons and anti-aircraft weapons, like the Javelin missiles and the Stinger missiles that we've all heard about. Thousands of those have gone into Ukraine over the past week during the course of this invasion, and they are taking a toll on Russian hardware as we speak. And that's really the most important thing that the Ukrainians need to be able to fight this war with some prospect of success. I think if we start talking about a no-fly zone, that involves direct U.S. NATO aircraft flying over Ukrainian airspace and shooting down Russian helicopters, shooting down Russian fixed-wing aircraft, and attacking any anti-aircraft surface-to-air missiles that they might possess as well. So that gets you directly involved in a shooting war between NATO and Russia, which is, of course, a nuclear-armed country, which has as many nuclear weapons as the United States does. And so that would be extremely escalatory and unwise. So I think it's best to help the Ukrainians with sanctions and to help them with military aid, but to recognize that this is Ukraine's war. There is theirs to fight, and hopefully they are able to prevail. But it's not NATO's to fight. It's not our war to fight indirectly. And that would involve extreme risk of nuclear escalation.
Jim, thanks for that call. We're talking about the latest developments in Ukraine with Andrew Kidd. He teaches about foreign policy and armed conflict at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions about the situation at 800-642-1234, what you want to see the U.S. do or not do. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our look at Russia's war in Ukraine. Andrew Kidd stays with us from UW-Madison, political science professor there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Andrew, you mentioned Russia's nuclear arsenal. Vladimir Putin has referenced that. He has put his nuclear forces on alert at one point, or he said he did. He's mentioned that he views the sanctions as an act of war. How worried are you about Putin and nuclear escalation?
Well, I'm somewhat worried, but not worried enough to say that we should stop supplying the Ukrainians with weapons or roll back the sanctions. So, yes, it's true. Russia has a lot of nuclear weapons. The United States has a lot of nuclear weapons. And so a direct NATO-Russia war or even military confrontation would be very risky. On the other hand, if you look historically throughout the Cold War, it was often the case that either the United States or the Soviet Union faced insurgencies, were engaged in wars in Vietnam, in Korea, in Afghanistan, both the Russians and us, where our opponents were supported, the people we were fighting against were supported by the other superpower or by someone else, and we accepted that, right? We didn't use nuclear threats. We didn't attack those countries with nuclear weapons. So, for instance, most recently, when we were fighting in Afghanistan, the Taliban had aid and shelter across the border in Pakistan. We had nuclear weapons. We conceivably could have attacked Pakistan with nuclear weapons, but we never even really considered that. So Putin may make nuclear threats at this point, but I very much doubt that he would push it to the brink over military aid to Ukraine. I think that would be very unusual, very unlikely. Now, it's true, Putin may find himself in desperate straits and may want to escalate, but I'm still fairly confident that he would be very reluctant to do that.
Let's go back to our callers now. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hello.
Hello. Great program as usual. My question is about if there's a reason for optimism. The sanctions have been greater than pretty much anyone expected, even the private sector. Russia is still making pretty good gains in the south, but is there a reason for optimism? Is there a possibility that Putin and the Russian forces would actually back out from this invasion.
Doug, thanks for the call. Andrew?
Yeah, I think the Ukrainian strategy here and their hope for how to win this thing is to bog down the Russians, hit their supply chain so that they can't refuel their vehicles, can't replace vehicles that have been damaged, and gradually wear them down and eventually get them to surrender in small units, then maybe in larger units, increase desertion, you know, increase all kinds of morale problems on the Russian side. And so not necessarily launch like major blitzkrieg-style counteroffensives that drive them out by the point of tanks, but basically make it like a Vietnam or a Afghanistan-style situation that the Russians realize they simply can't win, and they're taking casualties all over the place, and eventually decide to give up at some point. I think that's their long-term strategy.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Paul in Evansville. Paul, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about NATO. Why or what is the process for making Ukraine a NATO country, and why not? So I guess.
Paul, thanks for the call. Andrew, that was one of Putin's cited reasons, the fear that Ukraine could someday become part of NATO. What would it take for that to happen? I'm assuming probably that wouldn't happen while hostilities are going on there.
Yes, that wouldn't happen during the war, that's for sure. And that was one of the big demands and one of the big fears on the Russian part, that Ukraine would join NATO and the European Union. Don't forget, not just NATO, but the European Union was equally important because of the economic ties. Well, the process for joining NATO is a very long and involved bureaucratic process, right? It's a big organization. You have to form, make an application. There's negotiations that take years often. And it's a big political decision as well. And because NATO is an international organization that operates by consensus, every single member of NATO has to approve the addition of new members. So they would have to face quite a lot of hurdles to get in. And typically, NATO, that is, one of the criteria is that you have to have no civil war on your territory at the moment, at least, no international conflict that you're involved in, so that NATO doesn't get sort of dragged in right off the get-go into some new war. So Ukraine would have to be at peace. They would have to fill out this application. It would have to go through a long process. And it would also, of course, be a hugely political decision because, you know, from the Russian point of view, that's what this war was all about. On the other hand, from the Ukrainian point of view, this sort of only serves to reinforce and demonstrate the need for Ukraine to be in NATO. And indeed, even other neutral countries like Finland and Sweden, who have historically not been members of NATO and didn't join NATO after the Cold War, are now considering it. And the population in those countries is now trending towards favoring NATO membership. So this may be a really sort of an own goal for Putin in terms of driving exactly the phenomena that he was hoping to prevent.
Thanks for calling in. Marty joins us next in Lake Geneva. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. So you have a 40-mile-long, supposedly, convoy that is stationary. Why isn't Ukraine just picking them off here and there? It seems like they're sitting ducks. It doesn't seem to me like you'd have to take out the entire convoy. You pick them off here and there, and I can't imagine the boys just not hopping out of the tanks and walking away.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know tactically exactly what's going on there. Maybe that they have established some sort of defensive perimeter around them so that they make them harder to attack. On the other hand, from the Ukrainian perspective, that may be okay and like the least of their concerns at this point. If they are stationary and if they're not being resupplied, if they're not getting the gasoline and the spare parts that they need to move forward, they may be turning their attention to other things that are more pressing at the moment. But I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. But my guess would have to be that the Ukrainians think that threat is contained, at least for now.
Thanks for the call. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I don't know that much about the politics in the Ukrainian area, but I'm wondering if Putin is more interested in just acquiring Ukrainian territory as a buffer against NATO countries and really isn't concerned if he destroys the infrastructure of the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's one argument, although my so there's sort of a debate on what exactly Putin's goals are here. And some people think he wants to just install some sort of compliant government, puppet government that will do whatever he says. But others think that he is more ambitious and he actually wants to recreate the Russian Empire and bring Ukraine and Belarus back into a single state that's ruled from Moscow. I tend to lean towards that latter view, which I think may account for well, the invasion as a whole, of course, but also a certain reluctance to completely destroy the cities. So far, unlike with Aleppo in Syria, where, I mean, he couldn't care less about that, or even Grozny in Chechnya back in the Chechen wars, he might not have cared that much about that. He may still be somewhat reluctant to be seen as someone who's engaging in the mass slaughter of his fellow Slavs in Ukraine.
Thanks for that call. In just our last minute, Andrew, do you see any hope of a negotiated dial down of hostilities and then withdrawal of Russian troops?
Not in the near future, because I think the Russians, although their initial plan has failed, I think they still have hope of winning. And Putin certainly still has hope of winning. And Putin, I think, fears, possibly rightly, that if he loses and withdraws, that he might be overthrown as a result of that. And so for Putin, the stakes may be personal survival, not just win or lose the war, you know, nationally speaking, which would make him even more reluctant to engage in good faith negotiations with the Ukrainian side.
Andrew, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That's Andrew Kidd. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison, an expert on armed conflict, foreign policy, and nuclear weapons. He's with us today for a look at the latest developments in Russia's war against Ukraine. You can keep following the story there, here on the Ideas Network and over at WPR.org. We have reporting there from our colleagues at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, is there a bounce back for brick and mortar stores? Find out which retail chains are doing pretty well, even after COVID and competition from online retailers. Let us know if you are happy to go back to stores and shop. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Here's an opportunity for young artists around the state to have their artwork displayed in one of the most unique venues Wisconsin has to offer, the Front Windshield. The state DNR just opened up their call for entries into their annual contest to design the 2023 State Park sticker. They'll get you and your vehicle into parks and forests around the state. I don't have a chance of winning because, one, I have no artistic talent, and, B, this is a contest for high school age artists, so I'm a year or two past that. But if you or someone you know can meet those requirements, head on over to the DNR website for entry info. They suggest a theme of animals, plants, or outdoor activities in Wisconsin. They're taking entries until April 30th, so get drawing and good luck. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll look at media coverage of Ukrainian refugees. Our guest makes the case that many reporters are creating unreasonable distinctions between refugees from Europe and from countries like Syria and Afghanistan. Now, volunteers help keep Wisconsin parks and trails open and accessible for visitors around the state. The Wisconsin State Park System has a new volunteer impact system that makes it easier for volunteers to discover new opportunities across a variety of skill sets and public lands. Janet Hutchins is the Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the State Park System. Janet, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. I'm so glad to be here today.
Can you tell us, what is this new volunteer impact system?
Well, we're really excited to share this new opportunity and volunteer system that we launched in late February that is a new and easy way for volunteers to find opportunities and sign up. It offers a variety of ways to search by property name if you have a favorite property you're looking to volunteer at. by county, if you're just looking for one area in the state, the type of property you're looking to volunteer at. And those are just a few ways that you can find volunteer opportunities with this new system.
We've got a link to that system, by the way, at WPR.org/Central Time. Janet, how important are volunteers to our state park system?
Volunteers are critical to the Wisconsin State Park System. They make a world of difference to our mission of being able to enhance and protect our natural resources. With millions of visitors visiting our properties, they play a critical role in helping visitors enjoy their visit when they arrive, enhancing the natural habitat by helping us control invasives and planting native plants, and helping our facilities and grounds stay in great shape. And in addition to that, we have a lot of volunteers that help us with our programming, and they help offer programs to introduce people to our natural habitats, share the story of the land, and teach other people how to engage in new recreation activities like hiking, camping, fishing, so that all of our visitors can thrive and have fun outdoors.
If people are thinking about volunteering, what kind of time commitment could they expect?
Good question. We have volunteer opportunities, I think, that offer something for everyone. We have short-term opportunities like volunteer work days that happen year-round, but especially coming up this springtime as we get ready for the busy summer season with camping, trail maintenance, invasive species control, as garlic mustard emerges. So these are opportunities that you can sign up in the new system to drop in for a few hours of volunteer work and then stay and play and enjoy the property for the rest of the day. But in addition to that, we have longer term volunteer opportunities where you can stay at the property as a campground host for a few weeks to a month and sometimes longer to help greet campers, provide information about our facilities and education programs, or maybe serve as a naturalist or a nature center host, providing natural history programs and hikes and learn to recreate programs. We also have volunteers at our visitor services center as they arrive at the property. Visitor service volunteers help greet our visitors and hand out information. And then we also have property maintenance volunteers who help us with our building and grounds and keep them looking nice and clean, and help us with things like invasive species control and trail maintenance. We also have another program called Adopt a Trail, similar to the Adopt a Highway program, where volunteers can sign up with a group and come out a few times a year to help monitor a segment of trail and monitor for hazards and do some light trail maintenance.
Talking to Janet Hutchins from the Wisconsin State Park System, looking at volunteer opportunities in our state parks. You also work with friends groups, Janet. How do people get involved with those? What do they do for their local parks?
Yeah, our friends groups are a really valuable component to our program, and that's a great way to volunteer if you're looking to get involved with a group and not volunteer independently, but getting involved with a group that is already on the ground and has activities planned and plans fun events at the different properties. We have 64 friends groups to choose from that support a specific property. So you can go online and check out our parks web pages for friends groups and see which groups might be near where you live.
I know a lot of us are pretty connected to our state parks in Wisconsin already. When you talk to volunteers and friends group members, what do you hear from them about their connection to the parks now that they're not just visiting, but actually getting involved in them?
Our volunteers are really passionate about serving at the state parks, and they share their time and talents in jobs that fit with their passion and their interests. And they're really excited about helping us provide more opportunities for our visitors and help improve the parks to offer more recreation opportunities and facilities. Our friends groups do a lot of fundraising where they build new shelters, help put in new campground fire rings, picnic tables, all types of ways that they help enhance the park, and it helps them feel good, stay active, and get outdoors, and gives them a true sense of well-being.
And Janet, you mentioned there are year-round opportunities to volunteer, but spring is, it kind of makes sense, the busy season. Are you in need right now? Do you need a lot of people signing up over the next couple of few weeks?
Yeah, we do. If you take a look at our new online system, you'll be able to see the different volunteer opportunities, either the individual ones that I spoke about, or we'll be having some spring cleanup days coming up, and they'll be listed online as well. So you can take advantage of that and drop in and help us for a few hours, and then go and play in the park and find some recreation opportunities that you love.
Janet, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Janet Hutchins, Friends Group and Volunteer Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin State Park System. She was with us today highlighting the importance of volunteers for Wisconsin's parks and trails. We have a link to the online volunteer resource where you can find opportunities near you. We've got a link up at WPR.org/Central Time. That's WPR.org/Central Time. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about language.
The United States is a nation of immigrants, and the pressure to assimilate can be great. Some people are compelled to speak English and leave other languages behind. Here's contributor Eric Dregney with a look back at his own family's relationship with language.
Those traitorous Scandinavian languages. Don't be suspected. My grandparents spoke a mix of Norwegian and Swedish, or Svorsk, as it was known. They used it mostly when they wanted an unintelligible language to keep secrets from the grandkids. How I wish they'd passed on this language to me! Being second-generation Scandinavians, they wanted to keep their distance from their immigrant parents, and their thick accents, and their old-world ways. I used to believe this. I thought that the old language fell into disuse, and immigrants wanted to learn English. This perpetuated half-truth doesn't tell the tale of government agents spying on Scandinavian and German meetings looking for socialists or anti-war activists. Settlers spoke English as a matter of self-preservation, and any dissension was deemed unpatriotic. My grandfather told me he could only speak Norwegian when he entered kindergarten, and then would get in trouble since he didn't know English. How could he? I begged my grandfather to teach me Norwegian, but he warned me, "We're in America. We speak English. It's better that way." Clearly, he was scared of something I didn't understand. Then I discovered that some state governments set up a Commission of Public Safety during World War I. Its purpose, to root out those deemed untrustworthy. It was mostly Germans and Scandinavians by default, those with mixed loyalty who could be considered traitors. These commissions employed virtually dictatorial powers to distribute pro-war propaganda and to restrict activities it considered hostile. These government agents infiltrated meetings and rallies to make lists of radicals and slackers, as well as just plain foreigners who lacked enthusiasm to go to war. Because it was wartime, those who questioned could be locked up indefinitely. These commissions posted notices that read, "Don't be suspected. Use American language. America is our home." This is why my grandfather was afraid. But apparently, the story was not unique. A young Swedish boy in Ashland, Wisconsin, during World War I said, "We never speak Swedish on the street. Olaf was roughed up by some of the Yankee boys in a restaurant last week." Because Scandinavian languages are somewhat similar to German, anyone caught speaking them was viewed as having foreign sympathies and possibly a spy for Kaiser Wilhelm. Of course, it didn't help that the pro-Hitler German-American Bund set up Camp Hindenburg in Grafton, Wisconsin in the 1930s to help young German kids become good Nazis. Up until the World Wars, immigrants often had little incentive to learn English, since most daily business transactions happened in their native language. Jim Jensen, a TV newscaster from Kenosha, said, "If you went to the Danish Brotherhood, you spoke Danish. At church, the services, the sermon, my confirmation ceremony, all in Danish." Churches and social organizations tried to retain their language, although they were on the lookout for infiltrators. Many would begin conversations in English and then slip into their native tongue once they felt safe. Many churches switch services to English to show loyalty to the U.S., but mostly to avoid suspicion. One Lutheran parishioner joked, "I have nothing against the English language. I use it myself every day. But if we don't teach our children Norwegian, what will they do when they get to heaven?"
Eric Dregney teaches English at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Vikings in the Attic, In Search of Nordic America. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, a representative from the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association says the news media should be careful of bias when it comes to reporting on refugees and how they describe refugees from European countries as opposed to the Middle East or Asia. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, journalists covering the war in Ukraine have brought attention to the plight of refugees fleeing the Russian attack. But there's been some criticism over some of that coverage, specifically when correspondents make distinctions between Ukrainian refugees and those from Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria. Our next guest group has raised concerns about a number of statements by journalists. Here's one example, CBS News senior foreign correspondent Charlie Daggett reporting the first weekend after Russia invaded Ukraine.
But this isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen.
Mona Iskander is a producer and on-air correspondent for commercial and public media who's reported on a range of topics in the Middle East and in the U.S. She's a founding board member of the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association, AMIJA for short. AMIJA released a statement on February 27th, a few days after Russia began attacking Ukraine, responding to coverage of refugees. Mona, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. It's so great to be here.
We heard that clip there from CBS, just one of many on your list of examples. Can you talk about the concerns you have when you hear those kind of distinctions made?
Yeah, sure. So, We released this statement last week, as you said, and we listed a few other examples, and they were a range of print and television reporters who were out in the field, some of them in the studio, and they all seemed to be, you know, sort of unprompted, casual, spontaneous statements, conscious or not, that revealed a very obvious bias. You know, as we just heard Charlie Daggett saying, relatively civilized, relatively European. You know, by calling Ukrainians civilized, what does that mean? Are they more worthy of sympathy and coverage than others? And so it was really troubling to us to see these reports coming out. And so we came together as an organization. We've been around for 16 years. We have about 460 members around the world. The board, we're a very active board. And we said, you know, we really need to come out and say that this is just not acceptable.
And your concern isn't the coverage of Ukrainian refugees in and of itself, but it seems like there's a worry that if the language is used in that way, it could potentially do harm to refugees from countries that don't meet those journalist criteria of civilized, I guess. What do you worry about the spillover effect?
Right. So, I mean, just to be clear, this is in no way to say that Ukrainians under attack don't deserve the resources, the coverage or compassion that they're getting. I mean, absolutely, we stand with the Ukrainian people. But to, you know, for reporters, for journalists to come out and make these comparisons that are really just not correct and that are misleading, it misinforms viewers. And I think it really takes away from the story. You know, some other reporters, you know, they talk about that these are Europeans leaving in cars that look like our cars. There's sort of this implication that these Ukrainian refugees are not like those other refugees in the Middle East or in Afghanistan who are used to these sort of things. And so, you know, we just thought that was just not acceptable and we needed to say something about it.
Let's bring on a caller. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hello.
Hi. I mean, I think we're seeing this in more than just the media. I think we're seeing that in the citizens of the world. People are willing to donate more money, open up their homes, you know, give money to Airbnb for places to stay, which is wonderful. But you don't see that happening when it's refugees from Syria or refugees from Iraq or Afghanistan. So the media really seems to be reflecting the population.
Lisa, thanks for the call. I know your organization focuses, Mona, on the media. Do you worry that the media could reinforce that distinction that Lisa's worried about?
Yeah, I think that's a valid concern. I think, you know, we're focused on the coverage, but, you know, you see it also on the policy on the ground. I mean, there are, you know, in neighboring countries, the refugees are being welcome, whereas refugees in other parts of the world that previously wanted to enter into Europe were denied. And, you know, so I think she has a very valid point there.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. Mona, do you worry about when you see coverage of refugees from Afghanistan or Iraq, referred to in that clip we played there, or Syria? How do you see them being talked about compared to what you see in the pieces that you raise concern about?
You know, I think that there's a sense that, that people from the Middle East, refugees coming from Syria, Afghanistan, it's almost as if they're used to this. They're used to war. They're used to wartime. They're used to disruptions in their lives that would force them to have to flee. And, you know, that's just patently false. And it's bad reporting. And, you know, we're really asking journalists to do their jobs. And we're asking for newsrooms to diversify, because when there is more diversity in the newsroom, then there are more voices and the coverage just becomes much better and more nuanced. And so I think that, you know, there's a multi-part solution to this. And it really starts with the newsrooms. It starts with the journalism schools. But yeah, I think it's just not fair to be putting Syrians or Afghans in a different category, that they somehow deserve the situation that they're in.
Talking to Mona Iskander from the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association, a journalist herself, looking at how the media talks about refugees from Ukraine as opposed to Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq. Mona, has your organization got a response from any news outlets since you put out this statement late last month?
Yeah, so, you know, after we released the statement, we received a barrage of media requests from all over the world. And we actually decided to translate the statement into Arabic, Farsi, French, Spanish, Italian, so that we could get this out, you know, further out into the world. I know that, you know, the reporter from CBS did issue an apology. And I know from a source that an Al Jazeera English anchor actually lost his job. But we haven't received, you know, we haven't received directly anything from the media organizations. But look, I mean, the fact that we're even talking about this right now, the fact that there has been so much outreach from different places in the world, print, podcasts, you know, television, it just tells you that we're in a place where people are listening and people care about this. And when they see a double standard, it resonates with people who just see that as unfair.
Do you have suggestions for reporters, editors, producers, over how to check themselves and make sure that they're not talking one way because this is Eastern Europe and another way because that's the Middle East?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think, first of all, I think for reporters or producers, whether you're in the field or not, look around you. Who are the people that you're working next to? Is there somebody that has, you know, well-versed in the history of a country? Is that person of Arab descent or, you know, Iranian descent or can kind of help navigate a territory that isn't familiar to you? So I would say definitely look to colleagues, but also, you know, call up experts, call up, you know, you have to vet experts as well. So you have to know where to go. But I mean, we as an organization, for example, we aspire to creating guides for journalists for certain areas of the world. We did. We had a guide for Palestine-Israeli coverage earlier this year, and we are hoping to do more and more of these so that we can also be a resource for media outlets that, you know, when there's a huge event happening in the world and they're throwing reporters into that story, that we hope that they would look to us to sort of help them navigate unfamiliar territory.
Mona, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Mona Iskander, producer and on-air correspondent for commercial and public media. She's a founding board member of AMIJA, the Arab and Middle Eastern Journalists Association. We talked to her today about concerns over racial and cultural bias in Western news media's coverage of refugees, making distinctions between those from Eastern Europe and those from the Middle East. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, state lawmakers passed a new data privacy bill for Wisconsin. We'll find out what it does and doesn't do. We'll have a co-sponsor of that legislation on the show, plus an expert on our online information and who has access to it. And get along to get ahead. Don't rock the boat. Good advice, right? Wrong. That's according to the author of the new book, Insubordination, who has suggestions on when and how we should push back against the conventional wisdom at our workplaces and beyond. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at the rising cost of rent around the state and how it affects the lives of tenants in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.